as we're moving along in these days, as we come into the new Roman year, and we know up ahead comes God's new year. The holy days are just ahead of us a little ways now. As we're beginning our self-examination, hopefully we've been doing that all along, but as we're really focusing in on this particular time of year, we really want to make sure we have the right frame of mind. And so today I'd like to consider a group. I'd like you to consider a group with me that is mentioned in the New Testament. They're a much maligned group, and probably rightly so. Where did they come from? Why did they develop? We'll go through that very quickly, and then we'll consider some of the things that they were decried for by Jesus Christ himself. Most importantly, what we want to bring away from this today is to learn from their mistakes. What did they do wrong? What can we do better? How can we learn from their mistakes? Well, this group of people developed as the Jews were returning from Babylon, from being dispersed abroad. Originally, the nation of Israel had gone out, and then the nation of Judah as well. And they began to come back, but they didn't have a temple. They didn't have worship. They didn't have a temple that they could center their worship services at while they were dispersed. And so they developed a system of worship that involved what we might call synagogues. They didn't have a priesthood. They didn't know who the priesthood was. They couldn't identify most of the families, and so they were kind of at a loss, so they began to develop a system, a way of worshiping God. They recognized that God had punished them, or perhaps they didn't recognize they'd been punished for their mistakes, but they knew that they needed to be more careful. They thought they needed to be more careful with their thinking. And we've all heard it said in some form or another that in a room full of 100, there's 101 opinions. Well, in the same manner, these people, the Jews, as they came back to their nation, as they came back to their land, they all had different ideas. And a number of different groups developed. They all had the same main goal, though. Let's keep the idol worshiping out of the picture. We want to do it perfectly. We want to worship God exactly the way we think he should be worshiped. They all desired a separation. That's an important word, a separation from the way of thinking that led to idols. You had one group called the Shammai. They were very strict in their observance of the law. You had the Hillel. They were more liberal interpreters of Torah. The Habareans, well, they were very particular about ritual cleanness. You know, that's next to godliness, right? The Zealots. Have you ever heard of Masada? This was the group that attacked the Romans garrisoned there in Judea and fought against them and hazarded them and then ultimately ended their lives on top of Masada when they couldn't win the battle. And the Herodians. Now, the Herodians were more focused on political aspects, on government support. How can we get along with the government in place was the idea. There were many different interpretations of worship, but all, again, wanted to avoid paganism. They all wanted to avoid the taint, the infection. They wanted to be separate from the Romans and the Greeks that they were mixed up in. And so they were collectively came to be known in the Greek as pheres, which means to separate. Pheres. Sound familiar? It's where the word Pharisee comes from. The Pharisees tend to have a very black and white frame of mind. There are absolutes, right and wrongs. There are no grays to the Pharisees. And who decides what is right and wrong? Well, naturally, the Pharisees. They're the ones that decided. They became very strict. They became the new priesthood, in effect, coming out of Babylon. Now, by the time Christ came on the scene, there had been several hundred years of Pharisaical leadership. They were very entrenched in their way of doing things. They were the bosses. Everybody else listened to what they said. If a Pharisee said, you do this, you did that. You listened to what they said. You didn't question. You didn't argue. If you did, you can get in a lot of trouble. Well, now, Jesus Christ was very specific in dealing with them. He dealt with the Pharisees' habits and their interpretations very directly. He showed how hypocritical they were and how their ideas and thoughts didn't match true worship of God, the true worship that they were purportedly trying to protect. Well, does that seem harsh or kind of unfair? You know, they were there at such a time. They wanted to worship God. They wanted to protect the true worship initially. They kind of got caught up in their own ideas and their own interpretations. Well, he was pretty tough on them. Were they all that way? Maybe not. But as a group, in general, they were. They were very harsh, strict, and unforgiving. You can find places in the New Testament where the Pharisees are mentioned as disciples of Christ, a group of them here and there. There's a couple of them if you look for them. I'm not going to tell you where they are because you got to go find them yourself. But today, what I'd like to do is in a brief thumbnail sketch of one time that Jesus Christ dealt with a particular Pharisee and addressed some of their problems, and let's see what we can draw from this interaction that he had with the Pharisee. If you'll turn over to Luke 11, and go ahead and put a marker here if you're of a mind to do so. Luke 11, we'll start in verse 37. We're going to spend most of our time here. We'll foray into other areas, but Luke 11 is where we're going to find this interaction for the most part. Luke 11, 37 says, "And as he spoke," and that's Jesus Christ, "a certain Pharisee asked him to dine with him, and so he went in and sat down to eat." Now just consider this. The Pharisees are very particular about defining who is clean and unclean. From Jesus Christ's point of view, the Pharisees are unclean. They're not doing things the right way. And if he had a mindset like they did, he never would have spent any time with them. But as it says somewhere else, he was there to heal the sick. And so when he was asked, he went in. He knew an opportunity would arise to discuss their teaching and their learning and address it. So Christ's attitude, again, wasn't that. And yet that's in despite of how they tended to be themselves. In verse 38, we continue. "And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he had not first washed before dinner." So Christ goes in and sits down and just starts eating. He doesn't wash his hands. Now, let's point something out here. This isn't the wash your hands of you were out playing in the garden, digging in the dirt, and you're coming into the house to have a meal. Your hands are not coated with mud and junk and like that. You know, yeah, of course you'd wash your hands. But this was a ritual washing of the hands, a very showy presentation of washing of the hands. The bowl would come out, the water in the pitcher perhaps. The man would hold his arms out and the water would be poured upon his arms from the elbows down, and he would very carefully scrub his hands and forearms and rinse them off very, very obviously for everybody. This wasn't done in a little room to one side like what mom, you know, when you were growing up and mom said, "Go wash your hands, you were playing with the dog." Well, didn't we wash the dog? Well, anyway, that's another story. So very showy, very, very obvious showing of I'm clean. I'm setting myself apart even from you, how clean I am. So do we get that picture? So he marveled that he'd first not washed before dinner. And he's surprised that he hadn't done that, but Christ responds to him in verse 39. "And the Lord said to him, 'Now you Pharisees make the outside of the cup and dish clean, but your inward part is full of greed and wickedness. Foolish ones. Did not he who made the outside make the inside also?'" Again, the Pharisees were not concerned with about how clean their dishes were. It was about a show, an outward presentation of cleanliness. Yeah, you might have you ever been in a restaurant where you heard that sometimes they weren't all that really careful with their dishes necessarily, and maybe, you know, you might have heard a story about a dirty cup or something like that. And so you go in there and you order a cup of coffee and you're there with your wife or your husband and, "Yeah, I'd like a cup of coffee, but could I get a clean cup?" And so the waitress comes back and sets down the two cups of coffee. "Now, which one of you ordered the clean cup?" You know, that's not the point of what was going on here. They weren't that interested in the cleanliness in that aspect. They were always trying to find the difference between me and you. I'm clean, you're dirty, was kind of their thinking. Or if you don't do it my way, you're dirty, you're unclean. It was always trying to avoid this uncleanness thing to the extent that people were burdened very greatly by what they required of them. So again, we continue on in verse 41 as Christ points to this greater truth. It's not about ceremony. What is the truth? He says, "But rather give alms of such things as you have, then indeed all things are clean to you." So again, he's addressing the fact that the Pharisees want to cause a separation between people. At first they wanted to separate themselves from the Romans and the Greeks, and now they're even going to the point of separating amongst their own people and just placing these terrible distinctions on people and who's clean and who's not. Christ said, "Quit worrying about it. Who's clean? And take care of them. Love them." So now come the lessons. And we'll call these the woes because that's what he says. "But woe to you Pharisees," in verse 42. Woe number one, woe to you Pharisees. Watch out, be careful, you're missing something. This is very important. For you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs. Now rue, if you don't know, is a very small seed. There's generally thousands of seeds. And apparently they were going through and counting out the seeds. If you had 10,000 rue seeds, you had to pull out 1,000 seeds. And, you know, so very particular and nitpicky particular about the little details. Okay, so you tithe mint, rue, and all manner of herbs and pass by justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Absolutely, you need to tithe. He's not saying don't. Don't get that picture at all. We need to tithe. We do need to tithe. We need to give of our substance. But what's more important? What's the message here? There's a parallel account in Matthew 23 and verse 23, a parallel account of this particular woe, where it says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law." So you're doing these physical things, but you're missing the spiritual application. Justice and mercy and faith, these you ought to have done. Don't forget to love. Tithe, but don't forget to love. In verse 24, it continues, "Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel." So very meticulous, looking very closely to see the little bugs, but completely ignoring the camel walking into the picture. They claim to love God. If you claim to love God, you need to love people. You better be serving people if you claim to love God. Loving God and loving people go hand in hand. They are not exclusive. You can't separate those concepts out. Again, the Pharisees sought to separate the clean and the unclean people instead of clean and unclean ideas and thoughts. Christ says, love people. Open your doors to them. Open your heart to them. Over in Mark 12, 28, we see an example when one of the scribes, that's Mark 12, verse 28. This is an example of when one of the scribes came and they asked Christ, what's the first commandment? What's the greatest commandment of all? Well, they weren't really asking because they wanted an answer. They were trying to trick him. They were trying to fool him into catching, they wanted to catch him in a trap so they could accuse him of something. That's Mark 12, 28. But what did Christ say? Right there in verse 29. Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And this is a direct quote from Deuteronomy. And he continues, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength." This is the first commandment. And the second is like unto it, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And there's no other commandment greater than these. So you can't love God without loving your neighbor. We see that they go hand in hand. Let's go back to Luke 11 now, and we'll look at the second woe. "Woe to you, Pharisees." That's in verse 43, Luke 11. "Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplace." Would you like to see an example of this? It's really easy. These are the best seats in the synagogue right here. This is where the teachers sit. This is where the rabbi sits. This is where those who are somebody and particularly special in the synagogue, this is where they sit. Because they can be seen by everybody. And everybody can look at them and watch them and see what they're doing and what they're saying. And so everybody looks to them and they love these seats. They want to be invited to sit here or to have the ability to sit here. Now, they even have they tend to have a lot of pomp and ceremony when it comes to entering the room. Everybody else, you know, comes in, filters in, has a seat, and then there's, ta-da, here they are, our teachers. See how great we are. We're so smart. Watch us, see what we do. You know, there's this craving of the limelight. If you want a good picture of this, if you've ever watched the President's State of the Union address, you kind of see how it visually works. Obviously, you can see it here, but watch the President's State of the Union address. There's two people that sit up on a high desk right behind him that are almost always on camera. Boy, you really want to remember you're sitting there if you got that spot, because you're on camera the whole time. Don't fall asleep. Don't nod off. You know, you kind of get a picture. The idea is I'm even more important than you are, Mr. President, because my seat's back here. I'm in charge. We'll let you come in here and talk to us. Kind of that attitude, that desire to be seen and appreciated and acknowledged for their position and for their righteousness. Christ questions those motivations. Should we be craving the limelight? Should we be looking for applause? Do we really want to be that self-important or considered important by others? Jesus Christ tells us that godly motivation is what it's all about. In this case, the Pharisees didn't really handle that correctly. And that comes down to us as well. What are we looking for? Why do we do the things we do? What are the reasons that we get involved in anything? He's asking us, what is your motivation? What's it all about? Now we're coming to the third woe, as we pick up in Luke 11, verse 44. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Can you imagine sitting in somebody's home and telling them they're a hypocrite? It took some strength to do that. But he says, you are like graves which are not seen, and the men who walk over them are not aware of them. What's that all about? What is the picture he's trying to give us there? They may not realize this, but in Jerusalem before the Holy Days, they would actually go out and paint the tombstones. They would paint them because if you did anything or came into contact with dead bodies or anything that appertained to dead bodies, you were ritually unclean and you couldn't keep the Holy Days. You were outside the camp. And so to avoid doing that, avoid walking on a grave or coming into contact with anything dead, they would paint the tombstones. It's like, don't walk here. Oh, yeah, okay. I don't want to be unclean. So it's very important. You know, they went to such great effort to paint these tombstones to make sure nobody would be unclean by accidentally stepping on a grave. It was like saying, be careful. What he's essentially telling them is they should be painted because they're full of dead men's bones. They're toxic to other people. This painting of the tombstones was a warning. He's saying, people need to be warned about you. You're full of death and destruction and hatred. He says, you're whitewashed tombs, you're a grave. I mean, that's quite an insult, wouldn't you think? Hey, dinner was great and you're a hypocrite. Yummy. It was a pretty amazing thing, but he was addressing some very important things here. They were the leaders in this area, and they were leading poorly. They had a me-first attitude. You know, you're contaminated, you're unclean, and we need to warn people about you so that they don't come in contact with you and get poisoned by you. They had the power. They acted religious. They were in charge. Hey, it's good to be boss, isn't it? It's all right. We get all the best seats, and, you know, we get to make all the rules, and that's fantastic. Well, is that our attitude? We need to look at ourselves and have to ask ourselves, where do I get my principles from? Where do I draw my opinions from? What is my opinion? Are my opinions the ones that count, or are God's opinions the ones that are important to me? You know, if we think our opinion is so much better than somebody else, what are we going to do? You know, somebody else thinks something different about something, what are we going to do? Well, if you're not careful, you can begin to separate people just like they did. You know, we don't want to do that. We don't want to look down on others like the Pharisees did. We can't do that. We can't be a whitewashed gravestone. It's just not acceptable. Let's continue now with woe number 4 in verse 45 of Luke 11. And then one of the lawyers answered and said to him, you know, in effect, I want a shot at this. You just insulted this guy. It's my turn. I'm going to give a shot at this. Teacher, by saying these things, you reproach us also. You've insulted me, the man says. Christ doesn't back off. He goes, woe to you also, you lawyers, for you load men with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. You pile on guilt. You pile on burdens. You make it difficult. So many requirements. And you look for the loopholes for yourself. Isn't that what lawyers do? They find the loopholes. Just to give you an example of some of the things that would have happened in Christ's time. It's one of the 600 rules, more than 600 rules they had, was you couldn't tie a knot on the Sabbath in a rope. Couldn't take a piece of rope, tie a knot. Because that's work. You use a rope for work. No knots. What happens if on Friday you kind of forgot to pull the bucket out of the well and get some water so you'd have something to drink on the Sabbath? And you're pretty thirsty and you need to get some, well, you can't tie a knot. So you can't tie a knot on the bucket. You know, so that's not going to work. Well, it turns out that it's perfectly okay to tie knots in your girdle, the ladies. You know, ladies can tie a knot in their girdle when they're getting dressed to go to services. So you just take the girdle, you tie it onto the bucket and lower it into the well and pull the water out. It's perfectly all right because it's not a work knot. It's okay. No, seriously, I mean, that seems, it's funny, isn't it? It's hilarious. Yet that's one of the things that they had stipulated. Or how about this one? walking on the Sabbath. You all heard of the phrase the Sabbath day's journey. Basically, you get about 100 yards in our modern distances that you can walk before it's considered work. And that 100 yards is measured from your doorpost. As long as you stay within 100 yards of your doorpost, you're fine. So what the lawyers would do is make sure one of their doorposts was loose. Go as far as you want. Just take the doorpost with you. No problem. That was acceptable. Does anybody else think that's crazy? Or is it just me? Wow. That's not a sin, but leaving your doorpost behind is. How is carrying a doorpost not worth? Never mind. Let's not get too close to these things. This is a loophole, after all. Their way forces compliance. People don't have to learn discernment. Consider that. You can't do this. You can do that. Okay. People don't have to think. They're not required to have any responsibility by the Pharisees. They just have to do what they're told. Well, how does that help us to learn? How does that help us to learn anything at all? Life is full of these gray areas that are not addressed in specific in the scriptures, and we need to be able to discern, to rightly divide the word of truth. And so they were taking that away. They took that away from them. And Paul makes the same point in Romans 2, verse 1. Therefore, you are inexcusable, O man. Whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things. You know, they were adding guilt to others by burdening them with these impossible, ridiculous little details and completely ignoring mercy and faith and love. And again, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 17, we see a similar principle being taught. The Apostle Peter, in this general letter, is recording something that's very important for all of us. He starts this section by saying, in 1 Peter 2, chapter 17, honor all people. Who gets left out of that? Anybody? Well, no, he says, love the brotherhood. That's all of us. Fear God. Well, honor God. And honor the king. Everybody. Everybody, everybody. Honor everybody. That is, practice love towards everybody. And how do you do that? Well, by not berating or vocalizing when they have a failure, when they screw up in an area. Verse 15, just turn to verse 15. Like we read in Romans, instead of practicing this judgmental attitude, practice love for the brethren. Practice reverencing God. And how do we do that? Do we do that by condemning others? Or do we do that by arguing with them? Do we say, I can't believe what they're doing now. Oh, can you see what he's doing? That's wrong. Shouldn't be doing that. Oh, look how silly that thing is. Why is he doing that? That's nutty. You see, they've got to agree with us or they're wrong. Is that the attitude we want to have? Has God given us the seat of judgment? Again, let's go back up to verse 15. Instead of that attitude, instead of vocalizing that kind of approach, again, it doesn't mean that we accept wrong behavior. That's not the point. It doesn't mean we encourage wrong behavior. No. It doesn't mean you turn a blind eye to it. But our reaction, instead of dumping guilt on somebody, needs to be what Peter says here. Verse 15, for this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Somebody is making a mistake, doing things wrong. If their life depends on it, tell them right away. If it's a matter of a gray area, do what's right. Give them an example to live by. They're going to see it. They're going to be challenged by the consequences of their actions. And if it is required, you need to go to them and talk to them. But basically, it's not to point out their failures, but to show them how it's done right by living it yourself. Be the example. Do good. Don't judge. Instead, display the fruits of God's Spirit and do good. And in verse 19, it says, this is commendable before God. So back to our woes. Woe number 5. Don't worry, there's only one more after this. Woe number 5. Luke 11, verse 47, woe to you, for you built the tombs of the prophets and your fathers killed them. The Pharisees are like, what? How's that a bad thing? I mean, you know, hey, we got some fancy tombs put up for these guys. You know, they were prophets because we're taking good care of them. Yeah, you honor your fathers who killed them by building these beautiful graves for the prophets they killed. But you don't live what the prophets taught. You completely ignore that. There's a dichotomy there. That was their only link. Their only link was they built a really fancy grave. Yippee. So look at verse 48. It says, in fact, you bear witness that you approve the deeds of your fathers, for they indeed killed them, and you build their tombs, but you don't live by what they taught. Christ just cuts right down to the bone. He says, your fathers killed them, and you're honoring your fathers, the murderers of prophets. It's pretty amazing. Verse 49, it continues, therefore the wisdom of God also said, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they will kill and persecute. And so they were fulfilling that, these people. Do we want to be that way? Verse 50, that the blood of the prophets, which was shed from the foundation of the world, may be required of this generation. From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the temple. Yes, I say to you, it shall all be required of this generation. So from the beginning of the Hebrew Bible all the way to the end, A to Z, literally. A to Z, Abel to Zechariah. The blood of the martyrs was on their hands. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to impress people with pretty graves. They're trying to impress God. Look, God, we took care of their bones. We don't want to live by what they taught us, but hey, they're comfortable. They're dead, but they're, you know. Basically what this woe is telling us, you can't fool God. You cannot fool God. Building something pretty and beautiful that's full of dead bones is meaningless. What's inside? You know, they had this same hateful, murdering spirit that their fathers did. Do we? Do we carry around that attitude in us? Do we look at another and despise them because they don't think the way we think? Because they don't believe necessarily what we believe? Well, among the brethren, we need to believe together. We need to be together. But even outward, outside of this area, outside of this group of people, the others outside, how do we think about them? These are all potential children of God, and they have will have the opportunity someday to be a part of this. Will we burden them with guilt, or will we welcome them into the family and show them how to live the right way of life? Finally, woe number 6, Luke 11:52. Woe to you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter in yourselves, and those who were entering you hindered. These guys knew the prophecies of the Messiah. They were expecting him at that time. There were even some people, charlatans, who decided to, you know, hey, I'm going to get it on this. I'm a Messiah. Woo, you know, come hang out with me. But they knew what the prophecies were, and he fulfilled them in front of their eyes. And yet they would not see it. They refused to see it. They wanted to protect their position. See, he was coming there and telling them, you're doing it all wrong. And they're like, whoa, we're in charge, and there's more of us than you. That's it. We're done with you. They could have helped others to see that he was the Messiah. They could have steered other people to him. They could have put aside their position, their power, their prestige, and been on the winning team, effectively. What's the lesson? Well, knowledge is not enough. Knowing the truth is not the same thing as doing the truth. We can't rest on our laurels. We're in the right church. We understand the Bible. We have the prophecies. We got it made if we're not doing it, if we're not living it and loving other people. You know, the Pharisees were out to make themselves look good and defend their reputations by making Christ look bad. Some people are like that, aren't they? They can only really feel their self-worth if they demean somebody else. If they put somebody else down, if they hinder other people, and somehow that makes them feel better. You know, they go up the ladder by climbing the shoulders of the people ahead of them. Doesn't matter who they hurt, because they want to be on top. But that's not acceptable. Now look what happens when he tells them all this. Verse 53. And as he said these things to them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to assail him vehemently. By the way, that word vehemently, it's the Greek word dinos. Dinos, the same word, the word dinosaur. It means terrible, horrible, horrific, you know, just really powerful, terrible, violent things. So they were really upset, really angry with him. And they began to assail him and to cross-examine him about many things. And they were lying in wait for him and seeking to catch him in something he might say that they might accuse him. They were just looking for any opportunity to put him down so they could look good. And we can't be that way. We cannot be a hindrance to other people. We mustn't put our position or power or prestige ahead of other people. We need to be doers of the word so they can begin to have their mind more fully in the way of Christ, so that our minds can be more fully in the way of Christ. We need to put that aside, the desire. You know, when you think of these six woes, I hope that one thing comes to mind. What really comes to my mind is, woe is me. And not in the way that you've heard that phrase before, woe is me, but woe is me. How do these woes apply to me? How do they apply to me personally? You know, it's a reminder. I've got to completely admit that I've been guilty of these at times in my own little ways. I've been proud. I've been a hypocrite. I've demanded my own way. I haven't fully listened to the command of God all the time. I have to repent. We all have to repent. We need to take these woes to heart. You know, woe is me. I haven't fully tried to live up to the example of Jesus Christ. I've taken an easier road sometimes. But that's my goal. That's our goal, to live up to the example of Jesus Christ. It's what we all want to do. It's what we all should strive for. It's what we have to unconditionally give up our own way for. We have to get rid of this intolerant attitude towards others. We have to get rid of prejudicial thinking. We have to quit separating the clean from the unclean in that sense. Not that we should eat unclean foods. Again, don't get me wrong. But that's what we have to do. We have to empty ourselves of that pride, of that feeling. We have to empty ourselves of that separating idea that the Pharisees fulfilled so completely. As we think of these six woes, let's go before God and ask Him to help us see ourselves as we really are. Who are we? And we don't want to stay that way. We want to become like Christ. Let's go before God with these woes. Take them to heart. Cleanse ourselves of this thinking. Separate ourselves from unrighteousness in this way within ourselves and come closer to God. God loves us and cares for us. He is never going to leave us or forsake us. With His help, we can make this old Pharisee die. It might die hard, but with God's help, it will die.